Hard to believe a twisted little jump rope skipping rhyme originated out of the story of alleged parent killer Lizzie Borden. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. A lesser known second verse goes, "So close your door and lock and latch it, 'cause here comes Lizzie with her hatchet." Now, some sources say a newspaper peddler created this saying to generate sales, but no one really knows for sure. But this case from the late 1800s is a good example of how a relatively unknown person can become infamous, and how someone can plead not guilty at trial despite a mountain of evidence. Lizzie was born on July 19, 1860 in Fall River, Massachusetts, to Andrew Borden and Sarah Morse Borden. She had a sister, Emma, who was about 10 years older. Another sister between the two girls had died while a baby. When Lizzie was just 2, her mother died, and several years later, in 1865, her father remarried a woman named Abby Durfee Gray. She was already well into her 30s, so previously considered a spinster. Andrew was a successful entrepreneur. He was a bank president and landlord, admired for his business sense, but not very well liked, though he was said to treat his wife and daughters well. Despite his wealth, Mr. Borden was tight with money. The family had a modest home without indoor plumbing and used kerosene lamps, while other wealthy folks had gas lighting. Andrew Borden had lots of business dealings, including with both his second and first wives' relatives. Some of these exchanges produced tension in the family, in particular between Mr. Borden and his daughters. He's alleged to have made quite a few enemies in the community during his rise to wealth. Like their stepmother had, both Lizzie and her sister Emma grew into well-respected spinsters in their own right. Despite not getting along with their stepmother, even calling her Mrs. Borden rather than mother, both still lived at home. In those days, unmarried women just didn't move out on their own. Emma was said to be more like a mother to Lizzie than a big sister, having cared for her from the time their mother died. Lizzie was a Sunday school teacher and was involved in the women's anti-alcohol or so-called temperance movement. She was said to envy her richer relations and friends who lived up on the hill in Fall River rather than down by the mills as her family did. Now, in 1891, there was a burglary at the Borden house in broad daylight when only the two sisters, Emma and Lizzie, and their live-in maid, Bridget, were at home. The only things taken were about $50 and some jewelry from Mrs. Borden's desk drawer. The police were called, but a couple of weeks after the incident, for unknown reasons, Mr. Borden told them to stop the investigation. Apparently, Lizzie may have been the family's suspect. She was known to be a shoplifter in town. The clerks were just told to bill her father if they saw Lizzie take something. After the burglary, the family always kept all the house doors locked. Now, Lizzie wasn't a very good student. She dropped out of high school in her junior year, and she didn't have much of a social life outside of church, since other than a trip to Europe once, her father didn't go in for the fancy activities of other wealthy families. Instead, Lizzie kept pigeons in the loft of the family's barn. She was quite the animal lover. But sometime in either May or June of 1892, Mr. Borden got fed up with Lizzie's hobby, saying it was drawing neighborhood boys who shot at the birds. So Mr. Borden beheaded Lizzie's pigeons with an axe. The household got so tense that by July, Emma and Lizzie went on an extended vacation to get away for about a week. One day, in early August of that year, Mrs. Borden went across the street to visit their neighbor, Dr. Seabury Bowen, reporting the family and their maid, Bridget Sullivan, had all been sick for several days. Mrs. Borden told Dr. Bowen she feared they might have been poisoned, but the doctor believed it was probably just something they'd all eaten. Now, Lizzie told her friend Alice Russell that she thought someone, maybe an enemy of her father, had poisoned their milk and that she had seen a strange man hanging around their house and barn. The next day was August 4th, 1892, and while her sister Emma was away at a friend's house party, 32-year-old Lizzie screamed for the maid Bridget to run and get the doctor, saying her father had been killed. Although there was no sign of a struggle, Andrew's body was on the sofa in the family sitting room. with his feet still on the ground and his face smashed in by a sharp weapon. A short time later, Mrs. Borden was found on the floor in an upstairs guest room with blows to the back of her head. Now, autopsies were conducted, believe it or not, right there on the family's dining room table at 3 o'clock that afternoon. Based on the victim's body temperatures and the condition of the blood at the scene, the doctor thought Mrs. Borden had been killed between 9 and 9:30 that morning, even though she had been found after her husband. His face had been struck with a large, sharp implement, like an axe, from someone probably standing above and behind him. Many blows had crushed the back of Mrs. Borden's skull. The doctor stated that the first blow would have been enough to kill either of the victims, but the perpetrator didn't stop there. Lizzie and the maid Bridget had been the only ones home at the time of the murders, and the two ladies were questioned for most of the day. Now, their stories didn't exactly agree on several points, but here's a composite timeline of the morning's events. Mr. Borden had gone out, having been asked by Lizzie to mail some letters. He came back about 10:45 that morning, and Bridget had to let him in the front door. The back door, which he usually used, was bolted from the inside. As Mr. Borden walked in the front door, Bridget claimed she heard Lizzie laughing on the landing of the front stairs just above them. Mr. Borden asked where his wife was, and Lizzie told him her stepmother had received a note that a friend was ill, so she went to visit her. And remember, the doctor ruled Mrs. Borden was likely already dead by this time. At about 10:55, Andrew Borden told Bridget he was going to rest on the sofa in the sitting room. Bridget went up to her room in the attic to relax as well, and said she recalled hearing a nearby clock tower chime 11 o'clock. Lizzie told authorities she'd gone out for about a half an hour around then to go up into the loft of the barn, the same barn loft where her father had killed her pigeons. When Lizzie came back around 11:10, she saw her father's bloody body on the couch and called for Bridget to come down and run to Dr. Bowen's house. Someone had killed her father. Now, Dr. Bowen wasn't home, but after someone found him, he got to the Borden house at around 11:30. The police had been called in between around 11:15, and they got there by 11:45. During questioning, when an officer referred to Mrs. Borden as Lizzie's mother, she replied, "She is not my mother. She's my stepmother. My mother died when I was a child." Now, a search of the Borden property is said to have turned up two axes, one of which, according to one source, had hair and blood on it that turned out to be from a cow. Now, I couldn't find anything to support how this was known, since serology was in its infancy at that point, and even human blood typing was not yet understood. They also found what is termed a claw hammer hatchet, a regular hatchet, and the head of a standard hatchet with its handle broken off. No bloody clothing was found anywhere at the scene except the clothes on the victims. A fingerprint comparison was not standard in forensics at that time and was not used in the case. One initial suspect was Mr. Borden's brother-in-law from his first wife. He had spent the prior night at the family home and had breakfast with the Borden couple that morning. But when police located him, they learned he had spent the rest of the morning across town with other relatives and had a clear alibi. The maid Bridget was also briefly considered a suspect, but that was dismissed. Nothing had been taken, so robbery wasn't a motive. And although Andrew Borden had many business enemies, why would Mrs. Borden have been killed too, and first? The funeral was held 2 days after the Bordens' deaths. But police delayed the actual burial because they wanted another, more thorough autopsy. So a second examination occurred a week after the couple's deaths in the receiving vault of the Oak Grove Cemetery by a man, the medical examiner, who was named Dolan. Now, this is really interesting to me because this is the way I would handle skull trauma analysis today. They removed the heads and defleshed them, and that's when they examined Mr. Borden's face and estimated it had been struck about 10 times with a hatchet, which is smaller than an axe, while Mrs. Borden's skull sustained about 18 whacks. Dr. Dolan's report documents each blow in detail, including its position and its measurements. So, the nursery rhyme gets it wrong on both counts with regard to the number of blows, and the implement was not an axe. Mr. and Mrs. Borden's heads were not returned to their coffins for burial, but rather retained as evidence for a potential trial. Oh, and the couple's stomachs had earlier been taken to Harvard Medical School, and no evidence of toxins were found to substantiate Mrs. Borden's allegations that maybe they were being poisoned. But lots of possible poisons could probably have been tested for at that time, and quite a few others could not. Now, I mentioned that no bloody clothing had been found. But on August 7th, 3 days after the murders, a friend of Lizzie's, Alice Russell, who was staying with the Borden sisters, saw Lizzie burning a blue dress in the kitchen stove and reportedly said, "If I were you, I wouldn't let anybody see me do that." Now, Lizzie said the dress had gotten a paint stain on it. 2 days later, a judge held a closed inquest and ordered Lizzie, the maid Bridget, and a few others to answer questions. Bridget told the magistrate that Lizzie had been wearing a blue dress on the morning of the murders, but she was wearing something else when police arrived. During her four-hour interview, when Lizzie was asked where she was when her mother was murdered, Lizzie said she was in the kitchen ironing, but this is not a huge house. There were only 5 rooms on the second floor and 5 on the first if you counted the front entry hall. When asked why she went out to the barn, Lizzie said she had gone up into the loft to look for lead to make sinkers for a planned fishing trip. But the barn was searched that day, and it was said the loft was so hot no one in their right mind would have gone up there. Plus, there were no footprints in the loft, only cobwebs. It was also reported that Lizzie had been to the drugstore the day before the murders to try and buy prussic acid, which is what they called cyanide in those days. She said she wanted it to clean her sealskin coat, but then she denied it, even though the druggist and 2 customers said they saw her at the pharmacy. Now, Lizzie was arrested 2 days after the inquest for the double murder. She had to be jailed in a nearby town because Fall River didn't even have a place to house female prisoners. That's how unheard of it was for a woman to be arrested and held for something. At her arraignment hearing the next day, Lizzie Borden was charged with the double murder of her parents, to which she pled not guilty. A preliminary hearing was held in late August, and the judge found probable cause to move ahead with the court proceedings. At a grand jury hearing that happened in November, it was looking like Lizzie might not be indicted until Alice Russell testified about the dress burning incident. Lizzie Borden was jailed from arrest to trial, which didn't happen until almost a year later in June of 1893 in New Bedford. The state of Massachusetts had a mandatory death sentence at that time. She would be hanged if found guilty. Lizzie did have some support from her pastors and friends from her church. She also had an excellent defense team of 3 lawyers. Andrew Jennings, who had been her father's attorney, a young Boston attorney named Melvin Adams, and importantly, the former governor of Massachusetts, George Robinson. Now, while Robinson had been governor, he had appointed Justin Dewey to a judgeship. Guess who wound up being the primary judge on the 3-judge panel in the Borden case? Dewey, who in my opinion should probably have recused himself once Lizzie hired former Governor Robinson to defend her. Anyway, the prosecution wasn't too shabby either. One of those prosecutors, Hosea Knowlton, went on to become the Massachusetts State Attorney General. The other was William Moody, who after the trial became U.S. Secretary of the Navy, and then U.S. Attorney General under Theodore Roosevelt, as the 2 men had been classmates at Harvard. Roosevelt ultimately nominated Moody to the U.S. Supreme Court. The case was big news that was intensely followed by the media. Some of the defense's pretrial strategies were very obvious. Lizzie and her sister Emma posted a $5,000 reward for any information leading to the real killer. The attorneys put ads in the paper to try to find the person who allegedly delivered a note about a sick friend to Mrs. Borden the morning of the murders. But the defense managed to land two big blows. First, they got the judges to rule Lizzie's statements at the initial inquest as inadmissible because her lawyer wasn't present. So that evidence was never heard by the jury. Also not allowed by the judges was the testimony about the attempted prussic acid purchase at the Fall River drugstore. Surprisingly, even though Lizzie's visit to the pharmacy happened only the day before the murders, the judge said it was too remote in time to be considered by the jury, and that any attempt to buy poison wasn't really relevant to the crime, since the couple had been killed with a hatchet. So the prosecution went with motive and opportunity. Their first motive was the inheritance that would allow Lizzie to spend some of the cash her father held so dear. Second, they presented Lizzie's hatred of her stepmother. Their third main point was opportunity. I mean, there was no sign of forced entry, and the family kept all doors locked after that 1891 burglary. There were just no other prime suspects than Lizzie, but the bulk of the case was built completely on circumstantial evidence. The prosecution did have some direct evidence in the form of testimony. For example, Alice Russell, who testified about the burning of the dress. They also had some physical evidence, but none of it could be definitively tied to Lizzie. The hatchet with the broken handle found in the Borden basement, that was presented as the murder weapon. Forensic scientists, though they weren't called that at the time, said there was some kind of powdery white substance on its blade that had either been used to clean it or maybe make it look like it hadn't been used in a long time. And when medical examiner Dolan took the stand to try to match the hatchet's blade to the wounds in her parents' skulls, Lizzie swooned and fainted right there in the courtroom. Now, I've testified myself with a skull in hand while explaining my findings to the jury. You can imagine it provides some pretty compelling evidence. After 10 days, the prosecution finally rested. The defense, though, spent only one day presenting its case. Although Lizzie didn't take the stand, as was her right, her sister Emma did. Emma testified that her sister and stepmother had a fairly cordial relationship, and that Emma herself had been the one to tell Lizzie to burn that blue dress that was stained with paint. The defense also tried to poke holes in the prosecutor's timeline, and they brought on witnesses who said they had seen strangers in the area on the day of the murders. They also delivered up both a plumber and a gas line workman who said they had been up in the Bordens' barn loft just days before the murders, despite the prosecution's claim that the dust was undisturbed. When both sides rested, the judges delivered a jury charge that some have called nothing more than, quote, directions to acquit. It said the jury of 12 men took just 10 minutes to decide the case, but waited another hour just so it didn't seem like they were acting in haste. They found Lizzie Borden not guilty of killing her parents. The courtroom cheered, Lizzie cried and was released, and she headed home to Fall River. Surprisingly, that's where she lived the rest of her life, even though people generally stayed away from Lizzie Borden. She and Emma sold the family house, bought a mansion on the hill, and hired several servants. They took on that lifestyle Lizzie always envied, but Emma wasn't very pleased with it. She finally left town, changed her name, and stopped all contact with Lizzie. Though Emma never admitted Lizzie killed their father and stepmother, or even that she ever thought Lizzie had. Media followed Lizzie the rest of her life until she died in 1927 at age 67 due to complications from surgery. Her estranged sister Emma died just 9 days later. Both are now buried next to their parents, whose skulls were buried at the foot of their graves after the trial was over. In her will, Lizzie left nothing to her sister but money to the city for the upkeep of her father's grave in perpetuity. She also left funds to former friends, a cousin, and servants who had stood by her. But the bulk of her estate, $30,000, went to an animal shelter in Fall River. Now, one last bit of Borden trivia. There was a piece of artwork, a painting on porcelain, that Lizzie had at her house. She gave it to one of her few remaining friends, but the woman accidentally broke it and took it to an art shop to have it repaired. The store recognized it as being stolen from them years ago and asked the woman where she got it. Lizzie was charged with the theft but settled out of court. Now, shoplifting is a far cry from murder, but maybe that wasn't the only crime that Lizzie committed and got away with, at least for a while. Perhaps the discovery of the journals of Lizzie's attorney, Andrew Jennings, in 2012 will shed new light on the case when their details are released. Let's contrast the Lizzie Borden case with another more recent crime in which a middle-aged couple was killed, this time in Beverly Hills, California, and in 1989, just a little over 100 years after the Lizzie Borden case. Some of the similarities are remarkable. The family was well-to-do, the parents had only two children, but sons, not daughters. The boys stole from others to provide extravagances their father wouldn't allow. After the deaths of their parents, the two sons used their inheritance to finance the kind of lifestyle they wanted. The murders were brutal examples of overkill. The case was highly publicized, and the sons, but both of them this time, were accused of murdering their parents. Like Lizzie Borden, they pled not guilty. And the courtroom testimony the judges ruled admissible had a great bearing on the case. You may have already guessed I'm talking about the Menendez brothers, Eric and Lyle. Apparently, the idea for killing their parents came about while the brothers watched The Billionaire Boys Club, a movie in which a group of wealthy LA hipsters ends up committing murder. Following the movie, 21-year-old Lyle and 18-year-old Eric discussed how their father's pressure was just so overbearing. They couldn't imagine living with it the rest of their lives. He wanted them to work for a living. Can you imagine that? He wanted them to go to prestigious schools and be tennis champions. He had cheated on their mother and threatened to change his will to leave them out. The brothers decided, though, if they murdered their father, they would also have to kill their mother, because not only would she be a potential witness, she just couldn't live without her husband. How kind. On August 20th, 1989, Jose and Kitty Menendez had given the maid the night off and were watching television in the den of their 23-room mansion. Well, actually, Kitty had dozed off with her head in Jose's lap as he watched TV with his feet up on the coffee table. Apparently, their sons made sure the security system was off as they entered the house, each with a shotgun. According to the autopsy results, the boys most likely fired one round into Jose from the front, then walked behind him and put the shotgun against the back of his head and fired again. Kitty must have jumped up with the first shot to her husband, and as she tried to get away, slipping in her own blood and crawling on her hands and knees, wound up enduring a total of 9 or 10 shotgun blasts, 4 of those to her head. She had defense wounds on her hand from trying to block the blasts. Can you imagine her last thoughts as her two only sons fired shotguns at her? What's worse, the boys ran out of ammunition before realizing Kitty was still alive. So one of them went back to their car to reload. They were out of buckshot but still had birdshot. She wound up being finished off by a blast of birdshot through a gun placed against her left cheek. Then Jose and Kitty were each shot in the kneecap with the birdshot. This was to make it look like an organized crime hit. The theory the brothers later proposed to police was that their parents had been killed by the mob. Next, the boys picked up the shell casings, except for one, which Eric later admitted he spotted on the floor while the police were questioning the boys later that night. He managed to bend over and recover it before the officer even saw it. How'd the police get there? Lyle had called them. And unlike the cry for help in the Lizzie Borden case, the 911 call was recorded, with Eric screaming in the background and Lyle yelling not to touch the bodies. Lyle and Eric were not immediately suspects, so officers didn't do a gunshot residue test on them, which would have easily shown they were the killers. But within the 6 months after their parents' murders, the brothers had spent about $1 million. That's when police began to suspect they had committed the killings and started to use some additional interrogation to try to rattle the brothers and get them to turn against each other. But the case really broke when a woman called police to say that her lover, Dr. Jerry Oziel, was Eric Menendez's therapist. She knew the boy had confessed to killing his parents about 2 months after their deaths. She claimed that Lyle Menendez had found out about Eric's confession and threatened to kill Dr. Oziel. The therapist had asked his girlfriend to come to his office so she could secretly listen in on and tape a subsequent conversation with both brothers in case anything happened to him. Police got a search warrant that led to the audio tapes being recovered from Oziel's safe deposit box. The Menendez brothers were arrested in March of 1990, just over 6 months after the murders of their parents. You've probably heard about doctor-patient confidentiality and other so-called privileged communications, like between clergy and confessor or attorney and client. Those are usually not admissible in court. But you may not know that doctor-patient confidentiality doesn't apply if the patient threatens the doctor. Once Lyle said he would kill Oziel if he told anybody about his brother's confession, it should have removed the legal restrictions on what would normally be considered confidential communication. It took 3 years before the trial started, and during the typical legal wranglings, the judge ruled some of the audio recordings admissible, but not the one in which Eric described the crime in detail. Court TV filmed and broadcast the six-month trial that began in 1993. It was easily as much of a media circus as the Borden trial. The brothers pled not guilty, but a key difference between this trial and that of Lizzie Borden was that the Menendez brothers' attorneys acknowledged the young men did kill their parents, but said decades of severe abuse by both parents, physical, psychological, and even sexual, had caused the murders. The brothers claimed they feared that their parents would end up killing them, and based on that, the act was a form of self-defense for which they should be found not guilty. The prosecution pointed to the massive amount of money the Menendez brothers spent in the 6 months after the killings and said greed was the simplest motive. The prosecution also showed that the brothers had hired a computer expert about 10 days after the murders to wipe the family computer hard drive in an effort to erase the planned changes to their parents' will that would have left them out of the estate. The prosecution also pointed to the elaborate plan the brothers had developed. Shotguns bought out of town with a fake ID just 2 days before the murders, which were later thrown into a canyon on the night of the killings. And how the boys went out to the movies after dumping their bloody clothes and shell casings at a gas station, only to come home later and pretend to find their parents. Can you imagine them sitting at a movie after just committing a double murder, and of their parents no less? Although there was a single trial, there were two juries, one to hear the case against Eric and another to try Lyle, but neither jury was able to reach a conclusion. The district attorney requested another trial, which the judge granted. The judge in the second trial, which began in 1995 and lasted 7 months, did not allow cameras in the courtroom and was much more judicious about what he allowed the defense to present at this time, especially about the alleged sexual abuse for which there was not a shred of evidence. The result was two guilty verdicts and life in prison for the Menendez brothers, without the possibility of parole.